The fans are happy. NASCAR is happy. The legal team is happy. This is the best possible outcome.
Welcome to Navigating the Narratives, where decision makers from sports to politics and the media share their strategies, stories, and inside scoop on controlling headline issues when it matters most. And now your host, brand and reputation gatekeeper, Carrie Cecil.
Today on Navigating the Narratives, I'm joined by my partner, Ramsey Poston. Hey, Ramsey, how's it going?
Carrie, I'm doing well.
How are things in D.C.?
D.C. is... You know, it's great to drive here right now because there's just no traffic at all, which is very unusual. But we're getting through it bit by bit, just like everyone else.
I love that. In our last podcast, we helped to identify when the time was right to hire a communications expert for lawyers. And in this podcast, I really think it's important for us to understand the skills that a candidate should have. And I know you and I always talk about this and we speak about it and we teach about it. So I think there are really five top ones. I want to try to identify those. Do you think there's more than five? I mean, clearly there's more than five. What do you think?
No, I think looking at three to five is really the right thing to look at.
So I would say that if you're an attorney and it's a high profile case, I think the first thing that's one of the most important, I think they're all equally important, but is to hire a communications expert who understands the basics of the legal process, the stages of process, filing, appeals, judges, panel of judges, judge and jury. I mean, Ramsey, what would you add there?
Well, I think when considering litigation communications, more than any other concentration of PR and communications, litigation communications is more than anything else a real specialty. If you're a lawyer and you are faced with high stakes litigation that has the possibility of being covered by the news media and being very visible, getting a communications expert in there with experience is essential. You don't want someone whose main focus has been product promotion, for example. It's just a different skill set. Standing on the steps of the courthouse, speaking to media that cover courts and legal issues is very different than anything else. And you want someone who's been there before and knows how to do it.
I love that. So understanding that process and how it works is critical. One of the things that I remind people, because we work with so many inside counsel and even inside strategic communications teams, those communications people are valuable. And I look at them as a family doctor. Everybody needs a family doctor. And what we are is cancer doctors. So when there are different circumstances, you go to different people with different skill sets. So I believe that there's the need for that strategic communications person or the PR person that's internal or external. But when facing high stakes, high profile litigation cases, you have to go to someone who understands the basic legal process. It's a valuable prerequisite.
Another really important element of this, Carrie, is someone who understands basic terminology. A good litigation communications person is going to be someone who, at a minimum, has the ability and is going to read through all of the filings. And sometimes these can be substantial. These filings are stacked with a lot of legal terms and Latin terms, some of them very basic. But understanding how they are so that you can put what's in the filings into context is really important for a litigation communications expert.
Absolutely. And those vary from understanding diligence or administrative law or cause of action or, you know, misdemeanors, felonies. And you were one of the first people who said to me years ago, don't be afraid to ask because you need to work in lockstep. So don't be afraid to ask. And it's okay sometimes not to know, but you have to learn it. And it's a specialty in terminology and the processes.
I think that's exactly right. I mean, there are, I guess maybe we could talk about some of the terms, you know, and look, some of these are really basic. You know, we talk about, you're going to see this phrase, amicus curiae, come up. this is a particularly important one in PR terms. It means friend of the court. And a lot of times strategically from a PR perspective, if you can get another organization or lawyer or former judge come in and submit a filing that supports the client's position, that has both a great legal impact on the courts, but it also is substantial in PR terms and with the media. It's really good. But then there are other terms. You got to understand what the discovery process is. TROs, temporary restraining orders, basically is where one side or the other can ask the judge for more time to get more information. And then, you know, you might even see the term like in camera, which just simply means the judge's chambers. Carrie, what were you thinking in terms of what is the third element here that is important?
Well, I think the third element would be to hire a communications expert who understands the importance of working in lockstep with lawyers. And you already touched on that in that partnership, and whether that's developing messages that are based on the legal strategy and the filing, there shouldn't be a difference in the legal strategy and the communication strategy. So one of the things I remember most about a case that you worked on was the Kentucky Speedway versus NASCAR case. So in 2006, I'm going to take you all the way back to 2006, in that Kentucky Speedway versus NASCAR, I think it was a $1.2 billion antitrust lawsuit. It was the summer. Wealthy owners of the Kentucky Speedway launched that $1.2 billion lawsuit against NASCAR. And it was really an effort to use the legal system to award the track a NASCAR Sprint Cup Series race. But beneath the surface, the case had dramatically more threatening circumstances than awarding a single race. The case targeted the way NASCAR was successfully conducting their business for more than 60 years and had threatened to destroy the business model. So talk to me about that case. Tell me about some of the challenges of that case for you.
The challenge was at the time is that if the Kentucky Speedway was successful, it was an existential threat to NASCAR. Let me break it down and really simplify it. Basically, Kentucky wanted to be awarded a NASCAR Cup Series race, and they sued to get one. If you could sue and demand to get a race, I mean, think about what that could have ended up. If you had enough money, the next thing, some wealthy billionaire in Paris or Australia or the UAE could just demand a race and NASCAR would have to turn over and race there, and it would be chaos. And long gone would be the current schedule and where we race today or where NASCAR races today. NASCAR hired the great David Boies, and I worked with David Boies, who's by most people considered to be one of the great litigators of our time. And the other thing about David, he's also very media savvy. He understands the media and how to use it. But that case, everything that we did had to be in lockstep. And David Boies is very fastidious about what is said and when and how. We worked together. We had a good enough relationship where everything that we were saying through the media was directly reflected in our filings, all the way to the words that came out of David's mouth before the judge.
I love that. And, you know, I remember working with NASCAR, and one of the biggest things for them was always keeping the core fan base, always keeping that audience on board. And I love the way that you developed, you know, the strategy, and it simplified this complex legal case, this legal messages, and yet appealed to the NASCAR fan base. It was amazing even back then to see you and David, just the partnership of making it work in lockstep to reach multiple audience. I think it was, you were far ahead of your time at that point. So,
and what was really important and where David actually simplified the filing was to talk about the relevant market. So think about this. In the same way that 7-Eleven cannot demand that Coca-Cola be sold at 7-Elevens, Coca-Cola gets to decide where it distributes its products to. If it wants to distribute its products to 7-Eleven or Safeway or Wawa, whatever it is, they can distribute that product wherever else. What the court found, and David made it very simple and I was able to communicate it, was that NASCAR has the same right, just like the NFL, Major League Baseball, NBA, National Hockey League, to distribute its product where it wants to distribute its product, and it couldn't be sued to distribute someplace against its will.
I don't want to skip to the end because it was such a complex and exciting, if these types of things excite you, which they do for me. But I'm going to skip to the end a little bit because one of the things I loved, and I'm going to read it, I have it, is your quote at the end. And you said NASCAR is very pleased by the U.S. District Court's ruling to dismiss this case. It puts an end to any question about which locations and dates NASCAR can operate its races. Like other sports such as the NFL, MLB, and the NBA, NASCAR can host its events where it decides is best for the sport and its fans. And you tied it together. It literally just gave me like a goofy chill on my arm, and I'm not lying. It tied it all together and made it completely understandable and put it in terminology that supported that, the findings and the victory, and made it understandable. I love that quote. So talk to me a little bit more about the results, because I know it was round after round in the courtroom. So take us back and tell us about the results and how you guys got there.
Well, the case was dismissed. And again, this was an essentially really important victory for NASCAR. NASCAR puts so much of its weight in its rule book. The one thing NASCAR has that it really controls is the rule book, which talks about how the sport is run, when it's run, how it's run, and where it's run. And so it defended that guide.
So we know the ultimate victory, but I think it's really exciting about the results and how it played out and how it got to be a victory. So whether it was in the courtroom or sustaining the successful business model, talk to me about that process.
Well, this was really a two-year battle. And again, it posed a very serious threat about it challenged NASCAR's business model. A U.S. District Court judge initially dismissed the case in January of 2008. And then an appeal was won by NASCAR in December of 2009, when a three-judge federal panel from the U.S. Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals rejected the claims by Kentucky Speedway that NASCAR violated antitrust laws by keeping it off the Sprint Cup Series schedule. Now, the interesting thing is NASCAR got that victory, but a couple years later, a funny thing happened. NASCAR expanded the schedule, and guess what? Awarded Kentucky a race date on the schedule, and that date remains to this day.
A win-win for everybody.
That's exactly right. And NASCAR was able to do it on its own terms.
So a win-win for everybody. The fans are happy. NASCAR is happy. The legal team is happy. This is the best possible outcome.
But it also protects NASCAR for the long-term future. And so this is an important part, and we've talked about this before, Carrie, is also protecting reputation. We did, you know, it was important to NASCAR and us not to just be painted or made to look like bullies and that NASCAR had something against Kentucky Speedway. But we had the reason that we worked really hard on that quote, and David had a lot of input on that quote, and every word of that was really looked over and very intentional, because it was important for the NASCAR fan base to understand what was at stake here. Had NASCAR lost this case, there could have been dozens or hundreds of racetracks around the world who would sue just to have a race. And then the entire schedule would have been blown out of proportion.
Absolutely. And I find it fascinating just how NASCAR evolved. I mean, they were one of my favorite clients, and just their sheer dedication, you know, dating all the way back to Mr. France and Mr. France Jr. and, you know, subsequently Brian and now Jim. You know, the sport has really evolved. And in those early years after they consolidated the broadcast rights, when you and I were in tandem, there was always this commitment to deliver the very best product to the fan base, and but also to protect the integrity of the sport, to protect the integrity of the governing body, to establish ground rules, and to grow. And that was what I loved about their internal team and people like Jim Hunter. And it was never about us, or greed. It always encompassed multiple layers of constituency and making them happy. So I understand, and that outcome of that case, I believe, really showcases it, that we weren't the big bad bully. We will give you your race, but we will give it to you on our terms. And we have to do that to protect the integrity of the sport. That brings us to number four. I think that having senior level relationships with key media for the vertical that you're working in is critical to your success. So an example of that, if I were thinking back, is something that you and I worked on together, would be working in higher learning for a collegiate institution in pending litigation, and the opposing counsel using a national media outlet to tell its story with an investigative journalist. And the investigative journalist having truly one side of the story that was painted very negatively and not accurately. I mean, that was the most important part. It wasn't accurate. It was sensational. It was scandal. It was, you know, a massive college institution. And so typical investigative journalism, you know, a couple days before the story's going to come out, they call for comment to the client. And so with the ability to maneuver that particular newspaper, we had had a history of transparency and cooperation on multiple cases with this outlet. We were able to say, give us the opportunity to balance the narrative. Send us your questions, not just a comment. And not only that, I think that you and I kind of good cop, bad cop them. And while we were participating in filling in the blanks and balancing that narrative and answering those questions, I think there were 100 questions, then you were able to actually reach out, and we went over the head of the journalist, and not to be disrespectful to the journalist, but to ensure that they were complying, that we would be able to balance that narrative, at least to ensure journalistic integrity, cooperation, and that we weren't going to say no comment. And I think that type of experience in working with really good investigative journalists, really credible news outlets, they're going to give you that opportunity, but you have to know how to do it. I mean, what would you add there?
Yeah, so I think this is a great example of when you've got a, you know, you've got a plaintiff who has got a saucy tale to tell, and you know, I think in this case, and there's many examples of it, you know, reporters sometimes will go native and really start buying into this. And you can pick up these signals with interaction with the reporter in the way he or she interacts with you, the kind of questions they ask. And so I think in the case you're talking about, I think we saw enough red flags where we needed to politely disrupt the process a little bit, go to the editor and, you know, and say, use those relationships and experience to get a better understanding of what we were dealing with. And we were able to do that. And I think that slowed down the reporter. I think that allowed, I think that created a little bit better professional exchange between us and the media outlet. Ultimately, we were able to get a fairer shake of understanding what the reporter knew, where he or she may have been misled, and then be able to specifically respond to those items.
It was amazing to watch it. And while the story still had some elements of the original footprint, you know, I think you and I are both, we say it all the time, it's better to be 50-50 or 40-60 than get your bottoms beat 0-100. And that's why it's important to balance those narratives.
Yeah, totally agree. Another element of litigation communications services is the ability to understand public opinion and public mood in real time. And this is an area, Carrie, where you've really dedicated resources and time and created tools for this. Talk a little bit about how you've been able to use those tools in our dealings with litigation communications.
It's funny. I love data. I have become a data nerd. I'm going to just say I love data. And I didn't used to love data. And I'm going to give an example of that. So today, there are multiple ways to listen to what the audience is saying about your client in the court of public opinion. And you have to understand that in order to craft narratives, pivot narratives, and clench victories. So the reality is we use, you and I we all use data listening tools to understand the court of public opinion. And it can tell us whether the negative forces out there in the world, and it picks up everything from social media, chatter, fan pages, sometimes if it's in athletics or pro sports, it will pick up anything that is being written or said about you or the client online. And then it puts it into buckets. And whether that bucket is demographics, age, gender, location, influencers, all of these types of things will tell us what people are saying. And it's funny, I didn't used to embrace it. And I really have embraced it in the last, I would say, 5 to 10 years. And I'll give you an example of how, for me, it really rocked my world. So I was working and you know, we were working on a case in higher learning in the middle of a lawsuit, a fatality. Many of the stakeholders had been terminated that were there at that time, but the lawsuit is still going on. So our client was in the middle of replacing some of these different open positions. And one of the critical positions that needed to be replaced, they had several candidates in mind, high profile people. I plugged them into a data listening tool to see who was winning in the court of public opinion, because the reality was the candidates were being written about in all kinds of ways. And one of the candidates who was extremely popular in the court of public opinion, when doing due diligence on this individual, had a couple skeletons in their closet, like we all do. I'm not judging. I'm not in the judgment business, but had a couple skeletons in the closet that we had found with investigators and other things. And so I said to the stakeholder who was doing the hiring, there's absolutely no way that this person can be in that job because that person has skeletons in their closet and we need a very squeaky clean candidate. And everything in my fiber said, you will get crushed if you hire this person, if anything ever comes out about this individual. And I was working alongside a very reputable newspaper in that market who was also asking me about these candidates. And this newspaper actually knew about the candidates' skeletons. And I said, the rest of the world does not know. The journalist said, if they know, they won't care. They love this individual. They love this individual. For the person I was working for, I was like, I have to protect them at all costs. No, you cannot hire them. So the newspaper actually did an expose on the individual, and watching the analytics on that individual, it didn't even touch them in a negative sentiment. So I was able to go back to the stakeholder and say, if you hire this candidate, you're going to be fine. Because the reality is, what's done is done. That was a long time ago. People don't care anymore. This individual is the best candidate for the job, and you're going to be fine. And it gave the stakeholder peace of mind to hire the candidate that they wanted, knowing that they were not going to get their bottoms kicked, you know, going from the frying pan to the fire. They just let go of someone, you know, who had issues, and they're going to hire someone who has issues. It really gave them peace of mind knowing they were going to be okay. You have to have that data behind you. And if you can have science behind you and you can have data behind you, you can not only use experience and all of the other things we talk about, you know, you can have the reality of what the outcome may be. And that is critical in today's marketplace. And whether you're creating messaging and watching it work, watching it not work, pivoting it, changing it, you can see what's working and what isn't working with data. So if communications, litigation communications experts are not using data, they're missing a key component of how to be successful.
I think that's really well said.
So that brings us to our last piece. And I think we said we were going to have five, but I think we have six. And that's about experience. Hiring litigations, communications, experts who have real experience. Ramsey, you know my background, higher learning, pro sports, college sports, oil and gas, aviation. You know, you have NASCAR against AT&T, the Kentucky Speedway, and, you know, Yelp versus Hadid, Carpet Cleaning, Avondale Shipyard versus the NLRB. There are so many. Talk to me about the importance of having experience in this space and how it brings value to attorneys.
You want someone who's been there before, who's stood on the courthouse steps, that's dealt with not only attorneys and understanding how they work, but also on how to deal with media who cover the courts and legal proceedings. We've talked a little bit about it. I've been able to build my career on high profile litigation cases. We talked earlier during this chat about Kentucky Speedway versus NASCAR. But another really high level and intense case was NASCAR versus AT&T, which is a contract case. I also represented a small business near Washington, D.C. in Yelp versus Hadid Carpet Cleaning. I've worked with the shipyards down in New Orleans and represented Avondale Shipyard versus the NLRB in a very contentious unionization vote. And then have also done a great deal of First Amendment work, very notably El Dia or El Nueva Dia versus Governor Pedro Rosello in Puerto Rico. So being able to have done these things over and over, there are certain patterns you understand. There is a timeline, a legal timeline that you understand, and there are expectations that you are able to really hone and develop. I think that's really essential for lawyers when it's time to hire a litigation communications expert.
I couldn't agree more. And it's not something that you jump into. It's something that you over the course of almost two decades is built into a very specialized skill. And every case is different, but there are similarities in the processes, thankfully. And having the walking through the fire, understanding the processes and the outcomes and how to impact the outcomes is not something you can fake. It's not something you can make up. So let's recap. I know we had said we're going to have a handful, whether it was 3 to 5 or 4 to 6. But if you're an attorney and you're vetting a litigations communications expert for your next high profile case, there's really a handful of prerequisites that you need to understand. And that's to hire an expert in litigation communications who understands the legal process, who understands the terms, who understands the importance of working in lockstep with the legal strategy, who has senior relationships with the media, understands how to utilize that process, uses data to create narratives, and a candidate who has real experience in litigation communications. Is there anything else, Ramsey, that I'm missing?
No, I think that is it. I think lawyers and attorneys want to feel comfortable that if they're going to work with a PR team, that they have experience and can help them outside the certainly outside the courtroom and maybe sometimes inside the courtroom. I think that's really essential. And if there are attorneys out there or businesses today or general counsels who are facing critical issues, we're here to help. You can come to us and we can provide you more information and provide a consultation.
Our team helps to build, train, and navigate the narratives for headline issues when it matters the most. Thanks for listening to this podcast, and we hope you have a great day.
You've been listening to brand and reputation expert Carrie Cecil. Need help with crisis, litigation, or strategic communications? Visit www.anachel.com. That's www.anachel.com. And remember, when it comes to navigating your narratives through high-stakes issues, being pissed off is not a plan. Like this podcast? Be sure to subscribe to our channel and to share it with friends and colleagues.